From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2011 when two men used a 3D printer to create a prosthetic human hand. A research scientist named John Shull noticed that many engineering classes around the world were using 3D printers to create prosthetic body parts, but every time it happened, it was a one-off. It was a kind of a special product for one client, not based on a system that allows for more widespread use and distribution. So John Shull created Enable as a kind of online map for connecting 3D printing hobbyists with the people who needed mechanically enhanced hands. That program has grown. Today, more than 300 designers, engineers, medical professionals, students, artists, and more have created a kind of a network. Really amazing stuff. That story is just the beginning. Coming up, Shull will be one of the presenters at the second annual Effective Access Technology Conference at RIT. Open to the public, and they do want, not doesn't matter if you're a doctor or if you're a veteran, though certainly they want everyone involved with this, but it is available to everyone. And joining us in studio to tell us about this are RIT's Vice President of Research and Associate Provost and the conference organizer, Ryan Raffelli. Ryan, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Evan.
Farhat Sahin is a professor of electrical and microelectronic engineering at the RIT Kate Gleason College of Engineering, and we are going to hear about some of what Professor Sahin and his students have been working on. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And also want to welcome Dan Myers, the president of the Al Siegel Community of Agencies, a sponsor of the conference, and we should also say that Dan has been so intricately involved, as Al Siegel has, when it comes to disabilities, and so it's nice to see you here in studio and talk to you in person here, Dan. Thanks for being here.
Well, Al Siegel was on the news at noon in Rochester, and he always started with howdy neighbors. So howdy neighbors.
Howdy neighbors is right. You know, this program is part of Move to Include. It's a project to inspire and motivate people toward inclusion and to celebrate the abilities of those with disabilities. Move to Include, funded by the Golisano Foundation. But we really should say that Move to Include has it's become Move to Include. It was Dialogue on Disabilities First, and of course, Al Siegel was such a fabulous partner with Dialogue on Disability and Move to Include now. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks to WXXI. You know, you've given people with disabilities and the idea of inclusion the best public access that anyone in America has with the attention that you've given to our interest in changing the minds and hearts of people as they think about abilities.
Last little bit of housekeeping. I already had a couple of questions from listeners asking if the College of Collectible Knowledge was first hour or second. They're on the second hour today. That was a big thing on Bob Smith's show, and we're thrilled to bring them back, but that's not this hour. It's the next hour, and if you have antiques questions, second hour today. Ryan Raffelli, I started this program with the story of John Shull and the amazing work that's going on helping with prosthetic hands and 3D printing. And let me just start by saying, this is, as Dan and I were saying before the program, so far above my head. 3D printing of hands. I mean, we have really reached an amazing place in the technology of what we can do to help people.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story for those of you who haven't heard about this. And if you haven't, just go to the web and type in Enable and look at some of these videos. I mean, they will warm your heart, I guarantee it. Bring a tear to your eye. But essentially, you know, 3D printing's blowing wide open, right?
Yeah.
It's everywhere. They're using it for everything. Rather than taking a big chunk of something and kind of carving away until you're left with what you want, here you're just going to print it layer by layer into some three-dimensional object, and it's being used in all kinds of applications. Well, with regards to prosthetics, you know, before the Enable project, I really didn't fully appreciate the cost of a modern prosthetic. It is extremely expensive, and for many parts of the world, really financially out of the reach of a lot of people. Well, with these 3D printers, you know, and a little plastic, you can print them for a fraction of the cost. And there was a developer who developed, he focused on hands. That was another thing that I was really shocked to learn is how many children are born, you know, without fingers or, you know, only a partial hand. It's actually a quite frequent occurrence. And he designed a hand that will allow these kids to grasp and manipulate objects, and he open sourced it. He just said, here it is. Anybody who wants to use it, download it, print them off, go off and do great things. And so what John did is he put a network of all these people around the world who had these printers who would be willing to print off these hands. And, of course, they got orthopedists involved, and the next thing you know, they're doing this all over the world. And what's interesting, you know, if you think about a kid and the expense of the hands, kids are growing. So, you know, you may
interesting
a huge sum of money for a prosthetic, and within a couple of years, it's no longer useful.
I had never even thought about it in that context. Yeah. And that's just one more amazing part of it. Let's throw some numbers as to what Ryan was talking about here. John Schull, who is a research scientist in RIT's Center for Media, Arts, Games, Interaction, and Creativity. It's known as MAGIC. According to John Schull, typical prosthetic hand you purchase from a company runs more than $10,000, but the materials for a 3D printed hand cost less than $50. So, you know, in his words, all you need is someone with access to a 3D printer that is willing to donate their time. And when I first heard that, I thought, well, it's a fabulous idea, but are there enough hobbyists who have the capability? And is this medically sound and medically sort of supervised? And the answer is yes, right?
Yeah, and I think you have a lot of orthopedist doctors who are also willing to donate their services to help out some of these, less fortunate. And, you know, that the $10,000 number that you quoted, some of the numbers that I've seen are considerably higher than that.
I think that must be just
the
baseline. That must be. And let's say you need a prosthetic hand when you are born, and then again when you're 5 or 8 or 10. Just amazing. And yeah. Farhad, I saw you nodding at several points there. You know, you're on the research and creation side of this, but what
yes.
did you want to add?
When you said 3D printing, do we have a lot of people who can hobbyist who has 3D printing? 3D printing in last 10 years gotten a lot more affordable than it used to be. It was about $300,000, $400,000 for one machine. Now there are more affordable machines the hobbyists can actually purchase and make those parts, as long as they don't require ultra precision in their models, which generally you don't need for the prosthesis. So
let me ask a question that came from some of my conversations this morning, and I always enjoy talking to people who are much smarter than me when it comes to these kind of subjects, just to see what people generally know. I mean, the notion of 3D printing is still, as you say, it's developing, it's still new to a lot of people, it's becoming more affordable, and thank goodness for that. But I asked a friend, when you hear 3D printing, what do you think of? And he said, my mind goes to a dark place. I think about plastic guns and technology that can do harm. And it is so refreshing to hear, Ryan, that that the forces of good are out there doing amazing things with 3D printing.
Yeah, I remember I first saw it. It was maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. I was on an airplane in Europe, and there was a little, you know, one of the in-flight segments, and they were talking about 3D printing in Germany. It really hadn't quite moved to the U.S. at that point. It was still sort of a new fledgling technology. But it's in terms of the efficiency of manufacturing, you know, like I said before, when you start with something and you cut a bunch of it away, you generate lots of waste. Here, you're not generating lots of waste. You're only putting what you want where you want it. And it's, in a way, it is printing at the end of the day. It's something that obviously Rochester is very well known for and very good at. But it's a way of manufacturing, kind of a new way of looking at manufacturing that has really taken off.
Farhad, is printing the right term for this, or is it really more manufacturing?
It is printing, because the machine is working like the dot print printers. The head was going back and forth and putting
like the ink. Old dot matrix
exactly.
printers? Wow.
So the same way it goes, and then, but the difference is it prints on the same location in the second layer. So it gets built up as it prints.
Wow.
At the end of the print, you have a structure held on some supporting structures. You remove them, and you have the 3D part. Just to give you an idea about the cost, I teach robotics, and the last semester, spring semester, one of my team, the three students, actually designed the robotic hand. They printed the hand, they put the servo motors, they put the fishing lines to move the fingers. The cost for the 3D printing was less than $100. And that wasn't possible several years ago. 10 years ago, it was no way. Now the materials are strong enough. They are not brittle. In 10 years, 15 years ago, you could 3D print, but they were just to show. Now you can print something and use it. That was the big leap that we actually jumped over.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, when they first started doing it, the material set that one could print was quite limited,
yeah.
Right? And somebody worked it out with one type of plastic, and that was it. At this point, the number of new materials that can be 3D printed that are under development is also huge. They're going everything all the way through metals and refractories and ceramics, and it is really exploding at this point.
Forgive the ignorance, but I imagine that 10 years ago, if you were creating something in this kind of process, if it was as expensive as, Farad, as you said, it mm-hmm. used to be, mm-hmm. you know, you almost couldn't afford to make a mistake. And now, you know, and again, my guess is the precision is remarkable. There aren't a whole mm-hmm. lot of mistakes. But you can do multiples, I guess, if you need to, given the cost difference now. Does that make sense, Farad?
It makes a huge sense, because the student team that I mentioned, they printed the hand with a lower scale printer with their own money, $50. And then once they had that model, we printed with a higher scale printer, which has more precision so that the parts are better and moves nicely when the hand moves.
Amazing stuff. We're talking about what's coming up at RIT with this conference, and we're going to get to the details in just a second, but we've been talking about the fact that with 3D printing, this worldwide network that the John Schull at RIT helped create is now helping people who need hands. And as Ryan Raffelli told us, yes, it's children born without hands, but you're also helping veterans who are injured, whether it's a bomb explosion or handling a device, etc.
That's right. I was reading about some of the things going on in the Veterans Administration, they're using these 3D printers now for far beyond just hands.
I imagine they are extremely interested in the future of this technology.
Absolutely. Shameless plug time?
Yeah, well, there's nothing shameless. You're here because we want people to know what's going on here. So you've got the conference coming up. Let people, first of all, know when it is. And we've given you a little bit of a taste of it, but there's so much more to dig into here. When is the conference?
Well, the conference is on June 17th and 18th. It's all day on the 17th and just the morning of the 18th. But the shameless plug is for that evening on June 17th, we're having a dinner with a special presentation on exactly what we've been talking about, the Enable Project. So John Schull will be there, and it should be a great
show. If John were in the studio right now, I could say, all right, John, that's a bit of a shameless plug. But he's not. We're just singing his praises. He's not here. Okay, and I think it's important to also point out that the conference, we should know several things about it. First of all, they'd love for you to register online, rit.edu/access. rit.edu/access. Register in advance. They'll get a good idea over who's coming. And again, it is not just for veterans who are injured or need help. It's not just for people in the science fields. It's for people who like cool technology. It's for people who want to see where the future of technology is going. It's for people who might have family members who need help, or parents of children, or really any number of people. And we're just starting to scratch the surface of some of it. I mean, we're talking about the hands. Wait till you hear about some of the other things coming up. But for veterans also, for veterans, Ryan.
Yeah, veterans get in free. If they want to stay for dinner, there is a charge for dinner. It's $20 for dinner. But, you know, when we were kind of putting together the pricing structure, the thinking there was, in a sense, they've already sort of paid for their attendance.
Indeed.
And so we hope to see them there.
And when it comes to a two-day event, if I'm trying to imagine a listener saying, hey, this all sounds interesting, don't think I can do both days, et cetera, what can people do?
So the conference is sort of organized around three different sorts of things. We have a series of keynote addresses. For example, we have Will Gunn, who's the general counsel for the Veterans Administration, basically the head lawyer for the VA.
He's been a little busy lately.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I would imagine.
I can't wait to hear his remarks. He'll be kind of kicking things off, but we have a series of keynotes throughout the day on that the 17th, and then another keynote on the morning of the 18th. But interspersed between there, we will have time where the attendees can go and look at the posters, sort of different scientific work that's being done at all of the neighboring universities and service providers. And then there's also a series of booths where you can actually come and see the technology for the first time and on display.
Dan, this has always, to me, been science fiction, and that's how we kind of began the hour. As we said, science fiction in many ways is becoming just science, and I am in awe of it.
But so are we at Al Siegel.
All the work at Al Siegel, you see so many people who are affected. My mind went to veterans with this and maybe children without hands, but you see so many people who can be affected in so many ways.
I think what this has done in our world has helped to open this audience more broadly, so that people with disabilities aren't segregated as an isolated population, that there are other people who can use and value these same opportunities and these same advances. So people who are getting older and face some frailty, veterans, a natural affinity kind of group. And, you know, as we talk about seniors, as we talk about veterans, we don't say what the deficit is as we talk about them. We talk about them needing some extra help, some adaptation, some assistance. With people with disabilities, we start with a disability and we talk what the deficit is first. And broadening the coalition, broadening the conversation is a really good way for us to take the dis out of disability and focus on this is something that we all need at different times, we all need for different reasons, and it makes just good sense. So this partnership with RIT of taking some of the ideas, the real life situations that people who live with disabilities have, and seeing what the other advances and advantages could be by spreading this more broadly has been very powerful for the agencies that are part of Al Siegel.
Dan Myers is the president of the Al Siegel Community of Agencies, the sponsor of the upcoming conference. Ryan Raffelli is RIT's vice president of research and the associate provost and the conference organizer. And Farhat Sahin is a professor of electrical and microelectronic engineering at RIT. And so the future is becoming now, but before we even get to what you're going to help present on at the conference, can I ask you to join the long list of researchers and doctors and scientists who've been on this program who I've asked to look into the future a little, 10 years, 25 years from now. What do you think our world for people with disabilities will look like, and what's different? What do you see coming that will enable people to change the way they live and deal with certain either injuries or afflictions? It's a big question.
Well, you know, it's a big question, but fortunately I am in the answering side of the question. So what I believe is now we are started to use the technology to enable disabled people. In the fact that is, unfortunately, this is my personal opinion, unfortunately, we are using technology which are developed for the able people, and then now those technologies are turning back and being used for disabled people. So here's the example. You know Kinect, right? Microsoft Kinect, playing in front of the Kinect, you play tennis and ping pong, this, that. All it does detects your motion and then finds out where your hands are and this, that. What we are using Kinect right now on our smart walker is to be able to make the walker to move around in the room and finding where the patient is, where the elderly person is. Maybe the elderly person is in need. Maybe the person fell down. So that same technology are now looking for a person, and as soon as the Volcker finds the person, it can tell us whether the person is sitting, lying down, or standing up, so that it can detect emergencies a lot quicker than the person can do. So for the elderly people, the elderly facilities especially, what the doctors do, they send nurses every often, but in between there's no interaction. What we are trying to do is trying to give them a Volcker where they can use the Volcker in the home, moving around from kitchen to the living room, from the living room to bedroom. And in the process, the Volcker is just a Volcker when they're using it. But as soon as the elderly person has a problem, let's say they fall down, the Volcker detects that and then tries to find out the condition in terms of the person's picture, the heart rate, the way that it actually the person was walking be right before the falling down, and then call the doctors and report. That's one way. The second way this year we are working on is also pressure sore. Pressure sore is a big deal for elderly population because as we get older, this is doctor's explanation to me, so hopefully it's correct enough. I'm not an MD. As you get older, our brain ability to move around, we move a lot even though we don't notice. You know, we sit here 1 hour, but we do move. That move is automatic. But as you get older, that automatic motion is deteriorating and maybe completely gone. So you sit, one person sitting 1 hour in front of a TV versus younger person sitting in front of the TV 1 hour is a different story in terms of coming up with pressures on your skin.
So the subtle little motions that we might not even recognize
exactly.
We're doing is our body's way of reacting to certain things.
Keeping the circulation fresh on your skin, basically, which we don't notice. We do it automatically.
And so what will technology change about that?
So what we are trying to do now is we are using the Volcker to actually find out the patterns of the person, how long the person sits, and how much the person moves, so we can report those numbers to doctors, and doctors can tell whether the condition is deteriorating or not. So they can say, okay, the person is moving less, thus the possibility of pressure sore developing is higher. Then they can take actions on it, maybe medication, maybe changing activities, and helping the person move more, so that before the pressure sore happens, you stop it. Because when, unfortunately, if it happens, getting rid of a pressure sore is a lot harder than stopping it from happening.
You're talking about pressure sores. I think just impact on, say, the spine from certain mm-hmm. postures, things like that would probably also be
exactly.
improved.
Exactly. What we are doing right now in the second version is we have a scale in the seat. When the person uses the Volcker and, let's say, sits down, we calculate how the person sits so that the center of body is shifted or not, so we can tell whether the person is leaning in one way or the other way, and so the doctors can actually observe what's happening in the process of a couple months so that they can detect if something is really going bad.
And the first example that you gave us with the walker, mm-hmm. you know, we all grew up watching the ads for I've fallen and I can't get up.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a case where you won't need to, in many ways, the walker may know it before you have to tell somebody.
Yes.
Whether you've fallen and are injured or you may have a different medical condition. How is it equipped to, you talked about heart rate, you talked about other things. I mean, that's a lot that it has to process.
Yeah, right now we call it unobtrusive robotics device, meaning it's a device, but the person who's using the device does not know that it's a robot. It looks perfect like a regular walker. It is all the electronics are hidden, all the cameras. We have an IR camera, a regular webcam. We have the pressure sensors on the handles. We have the weight scales on the seat. And we have a Kinect in front of the seat so that the person is going to use it as a walker. they don't necessarily interact with it. And we actually do not like that. The elderly people or the people who need walker devices, generally they don't want to have something watching them all the time, right? We all like privacy. So that's why we made it completely unobtrusive. The person it's not reporting to the center. It's not sending information to the center all the time while it's actually walking, even though it records and tries to find out the imbalance or heart rate from the webcam we detect, and also the IR camera for the temperature. In last years, what we were doing is we were trying to say, okay, if the person falls down, it will make a big bang sound. And then if we can detect that and then localize the sound, and the walker can go. This year, we actually are doing something better, we believe. We have this watch, which is Texas Instruments Coronos. What it can do, it can measure your temperature.
He's showing us a watch, by the way, for our listeners. Yeah.
And this is a gift from my students. That's what they wanted to give me as a graduation gift to me from them. And what it does is it tells you XYZ acceleration, it tells you temperature, it tells you heart rate, even if you have the sensor attached. What we are using it for, though, if the person falls down, the acceleration in their arm is going to be a lot higher than normal ratings as they are walking. That will tell us that the person fell down. And the walker automatically becomes a robot. Not transforming into a robot.
Yes, indeed. No, its functionality changes at
that point. Exactly. Functionality changes. It becomes an autonomous robot trying to find the person.
And does this approach work? Is it working?
Right now, it is working in the sense that the robot can find its way and then detects the person in its way as well.
How long until you think it's possible that we see this kind of technology with some regularity in American homes?
Well, what we are trying to do this year is trying to submit a proposal to NSF and together with RGH doctors to test this in their facilities, elderly facilities, and get some actual data, analyze them, and show the efficacy of it. And then hopefully from that point on, it will go through all the approvals. And we have to find a partner in terms of walker designers as well. But I think that's... Once they see the functionality, I think that will be a given thing. But we will have to do the experiments, basically, in the elderly homes so that we'll show that, yes, we detected if the fall happens, we detected earlier than usual, or indeed we actually see less pressure sores. As soon as we show that data, I think we will publish as, you know, academicians. We will be happy when we publish our work, but it will turn into a product for the elderly homes, I am sure.
Let's grab a quick phone call. This is Bernard in Fairport. Thanks for calling, Bernard. Go ahead.
Thank you. I don't really like – I've had this comment before. I don't really like this idea of the concept of disability. What I like to think about is, okay, you've got a shortage, so now we can take a bigger advantage of it. And my question really is, we talk about the manufacturing of these things using the printer. I'd be interested in the discussion about the design, the thing that could happen, and then the printer could basically react to the design. So, for example, and my example would be, what I would like is I would like the ability to have a special eyeglass made for specific tasks. And it would be really nice if I could measure how successful something was for me and then have a printer remake my eyeglasses. And it seems to me that given Rochester's background in optics, this would be a very interesting project for us. So I like the idea of measuring how good it is, being able to design a change, manufacturing to the change, and then testing the change. And I'd be interested in what's the process that basically gets ready to use the printer. Thanks very much for the show.
Thanks, Bernard. That's a complex question, a difficult way to start. Let me start with the actual, the most science grounded. Farhad, what do you think about that?
I think it is a very good idea, and it is exactly parallel to our prosthetic example, because not everybody has the same taste in terms of eyeglasses, especially sunglasses too, and that for that matter. So if the person comes up with a design for themselves and they can submit this design, and then the 3D printer can be done on it and printed and then sent back to the person, and they can test, and if they like it, they continue. If not, they can send a new design and then get the new glasses. I think it's pretty doable. I'm not sure about the cost of making multiple eyeglasses until you get the best one, but still, it's not going to be more expensive than something that you go with a designer eyeglasses, which are a couple thousand dollars as far as I know.
Ryan, that kind of a question, to me, what's interesting is that we immediately embrace it as a viable idea as opposed to, again, something that just seems impossible.
Absolutely. I think, and we touched upon a few of those points. The feedback loops, that's what he's talking about, you know, innovate, improve, you know, redesign, make another one. Are enabled now because of these new manufacturing techniques. They've taken the cost out of it. Before, you'd have to mass manufacture something. You'd have to have a big market. The ability to do one-offs and to iterate that way is now possible. I could see these sorts of things springing up where somebody wants something fabricated quickly that they could literally go get it done. And, you know, the rate of this iteration and the use of some of these new technologies. Like Farhat was talking about adapting technology, right? The Kinex. Mm-hmm. That's something we're actually going to be giving an award for at the conference. There's going to be three awards. One is the Paradigm Award for Best New Access Technology. What technology is really providing access? And then the second is going to be the Al Siegel Award for basically the best paper, the best scientific study. And then the third one is going to be the L3 award, and that's going to be for the best adaptive technology. So we talk about access technology, but adaptive technology is where we use something that may have been, like Farhat mentioned, developed for something else, but we're going to use it to help provide access. One other thing, you know, you talked about how quickly is this coming. It's coming at a rate which is almost just phenomenal. You see the exoskeleton being developed by the Veterans Administration, where they basically got something that allow a paraplegic to walk using either external sensors or actually wiring into the central nervous system. Farhat does a lot of work with these brain scanners. I was shocked to learn there's three different groups on campus of RIT that are all using brain scanners, where you essentially put a hat on and you can control external objects. It really is science fiction, but it's becoming science fact. And this is something that Dan and I talked a lot about in the early days here. The technology was sort of slow coming to the table. I mean, when you looked at canes and walkers and wheelchairs, they looked very similar to what they looked like 20, 30 years ago. But over the last year, and Dan can talk about it too, the rate of change is amazing. Look, cochlear implants. A couple of years ago, they pretty much didn't exist. And now, like, RIT has the highest density of cochlear implants in the world. So the rate is phenomenal.
And Dan, here's why I think this is so important to actually try to get a sense for the timeline. We are at a time now where life expectancy is probably going to keep surging ahead because of medical advances. And we see now, we're not living to 100 on average, but we're not that far away. And we're living with more quality of life later in life. And you want more quality of life later in life. So I think these kind of, what Farhat is talking about with the smart walker and things like that, will have immediate relevance the second they get a thumbs up, I would think.
And in addition to all of us getting older, in many cases, people who were born with disabilities are living full lifespans for the first time, or maybe the first generation and a half that are experiencing that full opportunity. So there's a different set of challenges and an evolving need that goes on as life changes. To Bernard's point about how quickly this gets transferred and applied, RIT invited Al Siegel, invited Heritage Christian, invited ABVI, Mary Cariola Children's Center, and the MS Society on campus for an idea lab a few weekends ago. Busiest time in the year of the school calendar for these bright students. 30 students gave up their weekend. There were 8 to 10 faculty and staff members from just about every college and every discipline at RIT. We came with real-life problems. For Mary Cariola Children's Center, it was how to use a stylus for a child who couldn't really hold or grab something. For the MS Society, it was how to transfer from a wheelchair into the car with a whole lot of clunky options that are available today, how to come up with something better. Heritage wanted an application that would help people with disabilities remember to take care of themselves and have good hygiene. ABVI had some fabulous ideas about what kind of things could replace visual acuity with technology assists. And so we presented Saturday morning. Lots of interest, lots of good skills. Obviously, people started designing, drawing things, and so on. We left. They worked all Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, Sunday morning. We come back Sunday at noontime, and these bright kids had already come up with prototypes in every one of the areas. And two of them are probably going to go into design and production this summer with some additional help. So you know what's different today than what was available to people with disabilities or people with special needs a few years ago is this technology is right there. And just as it's changing our own lives, it's got the opportunity to level the street and make access points in ways that we never thought for people who have been left out.
And, you know, this the effect it has on our students, it's really heartwarming. Almost every one of the students who participated in the Idea Labs asked if they would be allowed to continue on with these projects as they continue on to their academic career. It's just so wonderful to see how motivated these students become when they're not only, you know, learning and developing technology, but they see the positive end use. And the other real advantage that we have here in upstate New York and the Rochester region is the density of service providers in our backyard is unprecedented. We have the most and the best anywhere in the country. So, you know, in terms of having the people that are on the front lines who really know what the issues are and really, you know what a real solution is when they see it, we've got that in spades.
Coming up June 17th and 18th, it's the second annual Effective Access Technology Conference. That's the subject this hour and some of the remarkable applications that are becoming real life, affecting, potentially could affect millions of Americans. More on what the designers are creating and the way it can affect you and me and everyone's family. That's coming up next on Connections. You're listening to member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, the College of Collectible Knowledge returns to Connections. Jack Wanderman and Yvonne Jordan are in studio to help you understand what you have and what it might be worth. We'll not only take your calls, we'll preview the upcoming WXXI Antiques Appraisal event. It's all coming up with the College of Collectible Knowledge next hour on Connections.
Opening this week at the Little Theater, Palo Alto is a teen movie for the ages, an astonishing debut feature from writer-director Gia Coppola based on the book Palo Alto Stories by James Franco. Four high school students, all trying to find their identities in the crucible that is adolescence, start to spin farther and farther off-center, urged along by a lecherous coach played by Franco himself. The Star Tribune calls it the most honest, relevant film portrait of adolescence in ages. See details at thelittle.org.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. And as we preview the second annual Effective Access Technology Conference with our panel of guests, want to tell you that this program is part of Move to Include. It's a project to inspire and motivate people toward inclusion and to celebrate the abilities of those with disabilities. And Move to Include, funded by the Golisano Foundation and, of course, the Al Siegel Community of Agencies, has been such a great partner as we had the Dialogue on Disability become Move to Include. Dan Myers is here from Al Siegel. Farhat Sahin is here, a professor of electrical and microelectronic engineering at RIT's Kate Gleason College of Engineering. And Ryan Raffelli is here, RIT's Vice President of Research and Associate Provost. He's the conference organizer. And it is an RIT event, but it's at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. And Ryan, for people just joining us, let's go over the details again if people want to get involved.
As you mentioned, the main thing that I would point you to is our website. Go to www.rit.edu/access. And you can learn all about the conference, what the schedule is, who the speakers are going to be, the various awards, and how to register. And if you just want to attend a conference, it's $40. If you also want to join a conference plus dinner, it's $50. If you want to just come to dinner, that's fine, too. Learn about the Enable Project. That's $20. And don't forget, veterans get in free. One thing I wanted to mention, Dan was talking about these Idea Labs, which they are just the most amazing thing. And every time we do one of these, and I'm sure Dan would reiterate this, you know, you see a lot of the suggested solutions, but there's always one that you look at that and you go, wow, I would never would have thought about that in a million years. And what I've come to learn is that, you know, these 18 to 20-year-old brains, they're just wired differently. You know, they grew up thinking differently than some of us older folks do. And they come up with something that is just, you know, it's kind of out of the blue. But once you see it, you're just like, that is fantastic. But one of the you know, things about this conference, you know, with our original motivation, we wanted to get the technologists, the end users, and the service providers sort of in the same room and shake it up, right? It's really important that we do take these technologies all the way to fruition, to real implementation, to affecting people's lives. So part of that is, you know, manufacturing and the whole entrepreneurship part of it, you know, getting these into viable products or viable companies that can produce the things that people are developing. You know, I mentioned the Paradigm Award. Part of that award goes when, the best technology, they actually get space in our incubator, the Venture Creations Incubator at RIT. They get a cash award to help them get started. And we're doing some investor introductions so they can actually hope to get some financing to take those technologies to the next level. And with regards to the Idea Labs, those are run by Richard DiMartino. He's a professor in our College of Business, but he's also the director of the Simone Center for Student Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And he'll be talking on the 18th in the morning. He'll be giving the keynote and talking about this whole ecosystem of how we take something from the laboratory all the way to a commercial product.
We opened the hour talking about 3D printing and mechanical hands, and whether it's a soldier who handles an explosive and loses some fingers or a hand, or whether it's a child born without a hand, which is, as Ryan said earlier this hour, much more common than we probably think. We talked about the work of John Scholl that's been happening to connect people to 3D printing, and it's amazing how viable this is and how now cost-effective it's becoming. Farhat Sahin has been talking about not only a smart walker, but we haven't spent as much time on the brain-computer interface. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, I always had an interest in what we can do with our brains without just thinking about something. You know, we watched Star Wars and all those science fiction movies. We had people can do moving objects with their brains and this, that. So I always believe that we have some power in our brain that we don't use. So in 2008, actually, we designed a system which detects person's ability to, whether the person is thinking forward, backward, right, left motion without doing anything, just thinking about it. And the reason for that is we wanted to move a robot, hexapod, by just person thinking about forward motion, backward motion, and left-right turns. And a couple of my colleagues said, can't be done. And I said, well, we'll try. This is a research, and we believe that it's possible. And we managed it. We actually controlled the robot using our brain, my student's brain. He was the researcher, so he did it on himself. And after that, I said, okay, there is some possibility of detecting actions that you imagine doing. And can we actually use this for disabled person? And lately, last year, we had an idea of why don't we design a system where we can let a person just looking at the computer, and we show letters very fast, and we can detect which letter that they want to type, and then type on the Google. Once they are done with the word, they can click search, and Google Images shows up many images, and we show the images very fast, 100 milliseconds per image. Mm-hmm. And what we can do today is, as soon as you see something that that is you're looking for or something that you're interested, our brain actually generates a signal called ERP, event-related potentials, meaning, oh, I know that. But we don't do it consciously. It happens. Automatically, something you see that you're looking for, if you see it, it happens. So what we are doing right now is we are showing, let's say, person type fox. And immediately Google image search will show fox, the animal, different animals, Samantha Fox, the singer, and this, that. And we culminate that with Google's interface of relationship between the word and the pictures. And we show wide variety of images, about 10 of them. And then we show them quickly and detect which image actually the person is interested. So let's say the person is looking for a red fox. And when the person see the animal fox, we will detect an ERP signal. And then once we have that, we actually, in the back, we search that again and say animal fox. Then we see all kinds of fox animals, the red ones, the short ones, small one, whatever. So we show all those pictures, and a person actually can tell us which one they like. And after a couple iterations, maybe about 4 iterations, the person has the picture in front of them. And the person is just looking at the computer. Why we did that is because, you know, the person who has, you know, paralyzed from neck down can do typing on the computer, just looking at it, and do Google search, read, click, and all those things will be possible.
See why we want to go to RIT and talk about access technology? It's the smartest people around, and the toolbox is just loaded with things that are waiting to be open to change lives for people who haven't had this kind of access, have never been able to think about this kind of connectivity. So, it goes college by college, it goes professor by professor. We've identified, what, over 100 projects that are already in the works that have been going on at RIT, that until there was sort of this magnet to gather them, we had no idea that some of this was in so vital and so active.
So I'm the vice president of research, and I had no idea, because these things, as Dan mentioned, they exist in every college at RIT. There are access-related research going on, over 60 different projects, $16 million. But it was almost uniformly distributed. So, but after it was brought to my attention, it's like, wow, this is one of the biggest parts of RIT's research portfolio.
And, you know, RIT has had a 40-plus year love affair with NTID. So you would expect RIT to be really good at understanding the special needs of people with hearing loss and hearing impairment and so on. And by that, maybe being better disposed to understanding what life with a disability is like and what kind of accommodations would help. If you know, talk to people who have been at RIT for a long time, for a long time, RIT and NTID were good neighbors who looked at each other and nodded and were very polite. And then somehow in the last 10, 15, 20 years, the lid has come off that, so that every aspect of campus life, every aspect of academic life, every opportunity for research to really change lives has been galvanized, so that things are really happening all over the campus that are good for everybody, and especially good for somebody who has a hearing loss. So when we came to RIT 2 years ago to say, you know, we think the new world could really benefit by a close relationship between a community laboratory of services and a very enterprising research and technology institution, holy mackerel, you know, the floodgates just really opened up. And if we were in Ohio, we'd probably be going to RIT because of the richness there. We're 5 miles away. How lucky is this, you know, and how wonderful that if we can take the RIT expertise and technology and intelligence and tools and thinking and innovation, and add it to the really good community services, which Ryan is absolutely right about. This community has very rich services. If we can be a catalyst to make that happen and change the region, change the nation, change the globe, then we will have really made a terrific contribution.
Dan Myers with Al Siegel. Thank you so much for being here, Dan.
Happy to. Thank you.
Ryan Raffelli is RIT's Vice President of Research, the Associate Provost, and the Conference Organizer. Great talking to you, Ryan. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Evan.
And we certainly want to thank Farhat Shaheen for showing us some remarkable images of the future. And I say future. It's very close to the present. But, Professor, thank you for your ideas. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
The second annual Effective Access Technology Conference is coming up June 17th and 18th at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Go to rit.edu/access. Register in advance. Veterans are free. All kinds of things happening there, and you can get the full schedule there. And this program was part of Move to Include with support from the Golisano Foundation. And WXXI is helping to lead the change toward inclusion of people with disabilities. You can help us. Go online, take a very short survey. Tell us what you think of this program. Tell us what you think about Move to Include. You can find it at movetoinclude.org. Movetoinclude.org. We would love to hear what you think. The College of Collectible Knowledge returns to Connections on member-supported public radio next.